The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Dr. Deborah Russell.
Kia orana e te va'atuatua.
Kia orana.
Taku Uianga to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Speaker.
The Honourable Grant
Speaker,
Robertson.
I've seen a number of reports that emphasise the current strength of the New Zealand economy following the release of yesterday's labour market statistics. Yesterday, BNZ economists said, quote, for the economy, today's figures were all good news. More people are being employed, the unemployment rate is low, and on average, consumer spending power is on the increase. ASB economists said that the labour market radiates some warmth, and Stuff said, quote, the best pay rises in 10 years. Mr Speaker, I'm pleased to see we still have many New Zealanders who see the glass as half full.
What reports has he seen on the impact of international factors on the New Zealand economy?
Well, Mr Speaker, according to the ASB's latest rural economic note, dairy prices dipped 2.6% overnight against the backdrop of the escalating trade war between the US and China. ASB economists have said we are in uncharted territory with regards to the US-China trade war. Similarly, ANZ economists warned yesterday that global risks have escalated dramatically in recent times after developments in the US-China trade war. They said the escalation in trade tensions will hit both the US and Chinese economies hard and cause collateral damage across Asia in particular. Mr Speaker, we are cognizant of these risks, but fortunately, the fundamentals of the New Zealand economy remain strong. The books are in good shape, unemployment is low, and we are well placed to respond to these challenges.
How is the government ensuring New Zealand's economy is resilient to international risks?
Speaker, we have taken action to stimulate the economy by increasing investment, including through Budget 2019, where we significantly lifted both operating and capital allowances. This includes investing $10 billion more capital than the previous government has done. We have also, over the last 2 years, brought in an R&D tax incentive that is going to benefit 2,000 businesses. We're investing in regional economies through the Provincial Growth Fund. We are reforming skills and trade training to address long-term labour shortages and productivity gaps. We've established and are working closely with the Business Advisory Council to harness the expertise of the private sector. We're deepening our trade base and we're ensuring that capital is flowing both through the Green Investment Fund and the soon-to-be-established Venture Investment Fund.
Question number two, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by her statement that G.J. Thompson took a, quote, leave of absence, end quote, to work in her office as Chief of Staff? If so, did he take leave as an employee or a director?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, Mr Thompson took a leave of absence from his day-to-day duties at Thompson Lewis for the duration of his fixed-term agreement. The management of any conflicts of interest, as the member knows, is a matter for ministerial services. I am advised that ministerial services followed standard process and no issues were raised in the management of Mr Thompson's conflicts of interest. Mr Speaker, I would add, G.J. Thompson was only ever appointed on a temporary basis 18 months ago, while the intended permanent chief of staff was receiving medical treatment. This appointment should be seen in that light, a temporary appointment that lasted 4 months over a year and a half ago.
Does the Prime Minister accept that during that temporary appointment, Mr Thompson, as a director, had all of the obligations under the Companies Act to act in the best interests of his lobbying firm?
Mr Speaker, I accept that ministerial services had responsibility for managing any conflict of interest, and I've been advised that the conflict was managed based on ministerial services practice and also the Department of Internal Affairs codes of conduct.
Can the Prime Minister elaborate for the House how those conflicts were managed, such as that with his firm representing the firm Huawei that the government was making important decisions about at the time?
Mr Speaker, again I highlight that this temporary employment was 18 months ago. I'm advised by the department that the employment offer made to Mr Thompson for the position of Interim Chief of Staff in the Office of Prime Minister was conditional on Mr Thompson taking a leave of absence from Thompson Lewis for the duration of the employment agreement, and Mr Thompson confirmed in writing to Ministerial Services that he had taken that leave of absence from Thompson Lewis. It's also a requirement as part of DIA's standard employment process that office staff sign two codes of conduct and the completion of conflict of interest declarations, and that was completed.
Submitted question.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
One of the Prime Minister could point out to the last questioner that the obligation to act in the interests of the business is when you're about the company's business, not when you're not, which he wasn't.
Mr Speaker.
The Prime Minister can answer right up to the last bit, which was an assertion.
Yes, Mr Speaker, obviously the primary focus here, of course, was that the person in question fulfilled the obligations set out by Ministerial Services. They managed the conflict and obviously were satisfied that that was dealt with appropriately, particularly given the length of the contract.
Question number three, the Honourable Simon Bridges.
Thank you, Mr Speaker, to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government statements, policies and actions?
Mr Speaker, yes, particularly the Coalition Government's economic plan, which is creating jobs and supporting our regions, as shown by yesterday's Statistics New Zealand release, which showed unemployment has declined in 10 out of the 12 regions, and the number of people employed has grown by 92,000 since this government took office, Mr Speaker.
What was annual GDP per capita growth in the last year?
Mr Speaker, as I've spoken about with the member many times before, 0.9%, not far off what it was under his government.
Why does she think GDP per capita has fallen to just 0.7%, the lowest since 2011 and the seventh lowest in the OECD?
Mr Speaker, as we've traversed many times in this House, one of the issues that we've historically had in New Zealand is that we haven't had the productivity increases that we need. Part of the issue has been we're a low-wage economy. Very pleasing to see yesterday a 4.4% increase in wages, showing that the actions of this government are helping to stimulate wage growth in the economy, which is good for New Zealanders. I notice the member continues to fixate on those things that he is dissatisfied with. We continue to focus on the positive and driving the growth that will make a difference to New Zealanders.
Is it a sign of a strong, positive economy that the Reserve Bank has just now cut the official cash rate by some 50 basis points?
Mr Speaker, it's actually a sign that the Reserve Bank follows their remit and the obligations under their remit, which is maximum sustainable employment and, of course, managing inflation and trying to keep it at the midpoint. And that's the basis on which they've made this decision. Mr Speaker, if the member looks abroad, he'll note that there is a pattern of very historically low interest rates globally. In fact, I notice the member tends to compare New Zealand to Australia. In this case, I'd point out that their rate is exactly the same following the cut that's being announced by the Reserve Bank today. And I'd also note that actually their unemployment is sitting at 5.2% relative to our 3.9%.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
In light of that last question, would it surprise the Prime Minister to learn that the Reserve Bank cut the official cash rate 12 times under the previous government, including 7 cuts during 2015 and 2016, when members opposite were calling it a rock star economy?
Order. Order. The member knows the Prime Minister has no responsibility for that, and dressing it up with surprise doesn't bring it into order. The Minister of Finance will withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise.
What is her position on the protest at Himatau?
Mr Speaker, that of course, as probably all members in this House would respect, that people are free to protest, share their voices and opinions on issues of significance. And for the people at Himatau, this is an issue of significance. There was obviously, though, an escalation some weeks ago around the issue. I think it was only appropriate that we seek to de-escalate the situation, which is the role that myself and ministers have sought to play. Now there's engagement involving kingitanga, where we're seeking a full Māori, bi Māori solution, and I hope that all members of this House would support that process.
What's your position on the government buying the land at Ahimaato?
Many times when asked publicly, I'm focused on the solution that can be brokered via kingitanga, a for Māori, by Māori solution. The role of the Crown at present is facilitating those discussions.
So will you buy it
off? So what's your position?
Mr Speaker, I just gave it to you.
Well, can I just say that neither of you, we're having a discussion at Business Committee about the use of the word you, and both members did not use the word appropriately then. Simon Bridges.
Does she support a referendum on abortion at the next election?
Mr Speaker, obviously that member is asking me the question in my personal capacity because obviously every member in this House... I'm about to give an answer.
Order! Order. Does the members want an answer or not?
Mr Speaker, I am going to answer the question. I think it's only fair, though, that we highlight every single individual member of this House has their own vote. My position is not a government position. My personal view, as I expressed clearly yesterday, was that this is an issue I hope to see resolved this term, so I will not be personally supporting a referendum.
When did she find out about a referendum on abortion?
Mr Speaker, yesterday, that a member of this House may choose to put forward an SOP. As Mr Speaker, it is the prerogative of any member of this House to bring forward an SOP at any time during the course of debate. It's curious to me that the member is not familiar with the process of this House and the fact that an SOP could be raised at any time.
Does she think the non-release of Julianne Jenter's letter to Phil Twyford is open and transparent?
Mr Speaker, that's a question for the Minister or indeed the member.
When she said her government would be the most open and transparent ever, did that pertain to the non-release of Julianne Jenter's letter to Phil Twyford?
Speaker, of course the rules of the OIA still apply.
Does she or her office know the content of that letter?
Mr Speaker, again, this question is relevant to the Minister and the Member.
But also, order.
That's pretty much it.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Which does the Prime Minister consider to be more important? The fact that we have an 11-year low in unemployment, or whether or not a particular letter was written on a particular piece of letterhead? Which is the big issue for New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, clearly for New Zealanders, the fact that their wages are going up and the fact that 92,000 more New Zealanders are in employment since this government took office. Those are the issues that New Zealanders care about. They're also issues around whether or not we're investing in those who need it most. Skills and trade training, investing in an underfunded health system, building and creating more public housing spaces than has been created by a government in 20 years. I am proud of the issues that this government focuses on, and I have to say the fact
order,
that I do
order,
not have a
order,
specific...
Order, order. When I stand up, the Prime Minister sits down, and that answer was far too long for a patsy.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can I ask the Prime Minister, as leader, has she ever said that one of her colleagues is expedited, deleted, useless?
Mr Speaker, no.
Why have unemployed on the dole gone up some 14,000 and children benefit-dependent homes 8,000 in the last year?
Mr Speaker, that should also be caveated with the fact that, and I'm going from my memory here, that roughly 17,000 have come off the benefit in that period of time, and also that the rate... The percentage of the working age population who are on benefits is still lower than when that government left office.
A Point of order, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Now, Mr Speaker, I'm just going to ask you to, when you do your reflection on the day, have a look at the answer that was given to the question to the Prime Minister about the referendum. This is a referendum being proposed by a government party on a government bill. For the Prime Minister to say that she had no responsibility for that is, I think, quite wrong and not fair to the question time process. Further, you also allowed the Deputy Prime Minister to ask the Prime Minister to answer a question as a leader. So it's either one or the other. They're either Prime Minister, the leader of the Labor Party is either currently the Prime Minister and always answers as the Prime Minister, or are you allowing this new category of party leader to answer questions?
Speaking to the point of order, the
Speaking to the point of order, Mr Speaker, clearly, as you've articulated in some of the discussion around the way that this issue will be handled in the House tomorrow, it clearly is a conscience issue, and therefore there cannot be a government supported SOP. Secondly, yes, I did choose to answer the question, but I made very clear that I was doing that simply out of generosity and clarity, albeit that I was answering as a member, not as Prime Minister, because it is a conscience issue.
I'm going to indicate something. First of all, you know, I do have the right to stand, as members found out yesterday. And I'm going to indicate that the decision I made as to extra supplementary questions as a result of government interjections has just been reversed as a result of National Party interjections while that point of order was being heard. Points of order are always heard in silence. Further to the point of order, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Well, thank the Prime Minister for being so generous to the House, but the reality is we're also at the moment considering a bill on referendums, and it is also a fact that any referendum ultimately has a question approved by Cabinet. It's not changing under the new legislation that's being brought in. It's the way it has been all the time. So to suggest that it is simply a matter of conscience is quite incorrect, and I think you need to consider whether or not the approach taken to the answer to this question was reasonable.
Okay, I'm willing to deal with them. I'll deal with the second matter that the member raised first, and that is whether the Prime Minister has any responsibility for members that approach her, or her approach to members, or her description of members. She might well, in her prime ministerial role, describe members in that in that way. She has indicated that she does not. Right. So the second question, which the member phrased, the member put first, related to a suggested SOP to the bill, and it was in that context that the member indicated that, consistent with a ruling that I have made, that the matter will be treated as a conscience issue, that the government did not have a position on it, but she gave her personal position. Possibly this whole performance is my fault because I let the question run when there wasn't actually Prime Ministerial responsibility, and if that is the case, I apologise to the House.
Question number four, Jamie Strange.
Kia ora, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Trade and Export Growth. What progress, if any, is the government making on increasing trade and growing exports?
The Honourable Davis Harker.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. The government is helping deliver strong progress on trade to grow our exports. In the first 6 months of this year, goods exports have grown by more than 7% compared to the previous half year. From January to June, New Zealand sold around $31 billion of goods to the rest of the world, the highest half-yearly figure on record. Increasing exports is vital to job and income prospects in New Zealand, and so it's no surprise that with strong growth in exports, unemployment rate is the lowest it's been more than a decade and income growth is strong.
What have been the standout export sectors and markets in the first half of 2019?
Mr Speaker, despite some ill-informed commentary from some so-called exports at the start of the year, our trade relationship with China is very strong. Exports to China grew 29% to $8.1 billion in the first half of 2019. Elsewhere, under CPTPP, which came into force at the start of the year, New Zealand exports have grown strongly, and to Canada and Japan, For example, kiwi fruit volumes to Canada have gone up by 30% and 18% to Japan. Sheep meat exports to Canada have gone up by 14%. Milk, fat and butter to Canada has tripled in volume. Beef exports to Japan, frozen beef are up 44% and cheese is up 10%. These exports are delivering jobs and higher incomes and benefiting everyone from the farm to the factory floor to the boardroom.
Oh, that's really great.
What progress is the government making in establishing further trade agreements?
Mr. Speaker, we're active at trying to strengthen our trade ties bilaterally and plurilaterally. The upgrade to the FTA with China is progressing well. Our talks with the EU are continuing. They, you know, they're not without challenges, but they're continuing well. This past week, the Honourable Damien O'Connor made positive progress at the RCEP talks, which are also important. And I met with the new UK Trade Secretary, where we agreed to rapidly progress a high quality agreement with the UK as soon as they're in a position to do so. It's vitally important that we push ahead with these plurilateral and bilateral agreements, given the problems with the WTO and the rising protectionism abroad. Sir, these storm clouds are affecting global confidence and trade flows, and one of the ways that we can protect the interests of our exports is with better market access.
Yeah. Question number four, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith. Question five.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he stand by his statements, policies and actions in relation to the economy?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Yes, in the context that they were made, delivered and taken.
Supplementary. Is he at all worried that at a time when New Zealand still has historically high terms of trade and should be doing well, we have the lowest interest rates in our history?
Mr. Speaker, as we were talking about just in the earlier questions, this is a global phenomenon. We are seeing historically low interest rates across the world. What we do know is a combination of what the monetary policy levers can pull and what the government can do with our fiscal policy stimulus means that New Zealand can build on the strong position we have to weather this global downturn.
Does he agree with the Reserve Bank Governor's conclusions in the statement released at 2 o'clock, quote, indicators of growth have remained weak or weakened further over the past few months?
Just as the member has, we've both just received that statement, and I note that the tone of it overall is one that's a yes. There is a lower growth. We've covered that before in this House. That is a global trend. That is a global trend, and indeed that is reflected in the Governor's statement.
So what responsibility, if any, does he take for that weakened growth outlook over the next few months?
Mr. Speaker, the responsibility I take is for ensuring that the New Zealand economy is well positioned to weather a global storm. We've done that. We've kept debt relatively low. We have a government surplus. But at the same time, we have invested significantly by lifting our operating spending to $3.8 billion per annum, new operating spending, and by lifting our capital spending to historically high levels as well.
So following a statement yesterday, quote, on this side of the House, we understand that it's the government's role to stimulate the economy in times like this, end quote. Will he revisit his government's decision to stop or delay around a dozen major road projects that in several cases were ready to go in favour of new projects that won't be ready to go?
Mr. Speaker, no, I do not back off that statement because, Mr. Speaker, they weren't ready to go. There was no funding put aside for the majority of those roads. They were ghost roads. And where, Mr. Speaker, there was money put aside, as such as the Leader of the Opposition is interjecting about with the S-West Link, that would have been the most expensive piece of road in the world had we gone ahead with buying it at around $300 million per kilometre.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
As Mr. Simon Bridges or any member of the National Party showed that there was 1 cent in the walkwith to Whangarei Foreland Highway that they were promising.
Order. No, there's not responsibility for that.
His statement yesterday, quote, we are making sure that transport infrastructure doesn't go on a handful of highways, end quote. Is it his plan that it all goes on one tram instead?
Mr. Speaker, no. It is our plan that we actually have a balanced investment in transport. That means roads in the regions, which are getting a much better deal out of this government. It means improving safety. It means investing in public transport. And yes, it means investing in other modes of transport as well. It's actually the 21st century over here.
Question number six, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Health. Does she stand by her statement, quote, "the single biggest risk to public health now is our changing climate," end quote? If so, why?
The Honourable Julianne Genta.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. Yes, in the context of which it was given, of global health risks and the need of the health system to be equipped to deal with emerging threats and play a role in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. A study published in the peer-reviewed medical journal The Lancet concluded, quote, "climate change is the biggest global health threat of the 21st century." But also, quote, "tackling climate change could be the greatest global health opportunity of the 21st century." And the sentiment about the biggest global health threat of the 21st century is echoed by the World Health Organization. The threats from climate change include the spread of disease like dengue fever, increased pollution causing respiratory diseases and asthma, food security, health-related deaths and illness, and mental health impacts from drought. I'll echo what the Pentagon said, which is it's a threat multiplier, which could exacerbate many public health problems that already exist.
Is she saying the 9,500 New Zealanders who will succumb this year to our biggest killer, cancer, should be more concerned about climate change than getting access to world-class drugs and care?
Not at all, and our government has made significant commitment to addressing the issues faced by New Zealanders who need treatment for cancer by extending access to radiation therapy. Of course, we have to make up for 9 years of underfunding from that previous government. But this government can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Should DHB's focus on providing plant-based protein alternatives to address the single biggest risk to public health, as is recommended in the document she launched called, quote, "Sustainability and the Health Sector," end quote, ahead of, say, timely emergency department care?
The government is leaving it up to DHBs to make decisions about operational matters.
To the Minister, does she believe that hospital patients should be encouraged to explore walking and cycling options to hospital ahead of, say, effective increase in immunisation rates?
It is not the case that we have to choose between having sustainable transport options for staff working at hospitals and increased immunisation rates. In fact, there are many opportunities to get better health outcomes and better environmental outcomes and save money. This government is dealing with all of the serious risks to New Zealanders' health and the global risk of climate change, which apparently the National Party no longer believes in taking action on.
Well, the questioning line is actually Mr. Woodhouse.
Is the reduced throughput in elective surgery part of a government plan to reduce anaesthetic gases that are harmful to the environment?
This government has made, in the last budget, the biggest increase in commitment to health funding, a record increase. And, of course, we have to take all of these considerations into account, but ultimately it's up to DHBs to make operational decisions. This government is committed to making up for the 9 years of underfunding that has led to enormous pressure on our health system.
To the Minister, shouldn't she be focused on the things that actually matter to New Zealanders, like reversing the rapid decline in health services on this government's watch, rather than whether DHBs grow their own food?
Mr. Speaker, I'm very proud of the progress this government is making on addressing the many issues facing New Zealanders when it comes to health, investing a record amount of capital expenditure and infrastructure that was long overdue. And it is entirely possible, in fact, very practical, to invest in energy efficiency in those buildings. That both means there'll be better health outcomes for New Zealanders and lower operational costs for DHBs. It's a shame that the National Party never took the opportunity of being in power to invest in our health system.
Question number 7, Maria Lubick.
Rana, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Workplace Relations and Safety and asks, what reports has he seen this week regarding salary and wage growth?
Mr. Speaker. Kia rana, Mr. Speaker. Statistics New Zealand yesterday reported that the average ordinary time hourly earnings rose 4.4% in the year to June this year. That was the biggest increase since 2009. We're tackling the big long-term issues, and this government's economic plan focuses on making sure that everyone shares in our economic success. And the figures show that we are delivering a more inclusive economy that raises the living standards of all New Zealanders.
Supplementary, what does the Minister attribute this increase to?
Well, Statistics New Zealand attributed much of the increase to increases in the minimum wage and the settlement of significant collective agreements. I also attribute it to the Coalition Government's balanced approach of delivering more jobs for New Zealand and sound fiscal management to maintain a strong underlying economy in the face of global headwinds.
What message does this increase send to New Zealand workers?
Well, I think the message is that after 9 years of neglect, there is a lot to fix, but the government's plan is working. We can grow the pie and share it better. It also says, don't listen to the doomsayers. We can improve wages, we can improve workers' rights, and we can grow the economy at the same time. We can't solve everything straight away, but we are making good progress.
And I do want to say to the Minister who just answered the question, many of us noted his voice. I'm not asking for thanks. I'm recommending to him that if what is bothering him is viral, that he not come back in here and do it again.
Question number 8, Chris Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Associate Minister of Transport, does she agree with Transport Minister Phil Twyford's statement, quote, I received a letter from the Associate Minister of Transport, Julian Genta, on the Let's Get Wellington LGWM indicative package on 26 March 2019. If not, why not?
The Honourable Julian Genta.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. I can confirm I sent the letter on that date.
Well, point of order. The question is, does she agree with the statement, not whether or not she sent a letter on that date? It's, does she agree with her colleague's statement?
Well, I think she's indicated that the letter that the member was talking about that was received that day was sent the same day. I think she's more than addressed it. She's answered.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. The statement by Minister Twyford is actually critical to this whole exchange and the preceding day's exchange, because the critical point of Mr. Twyford's statement is it refers to a letter from the Associate Minister of Transport, Julian Genta, and she has claimed yesterday and on other occasions, or adverted to it, the fact that the letter was not sent as the Associate Minister of Transport. So whether or not she agrees with Mr. Twyford's statement to the Parliament through a written question is actually of critical importance.
I think it's fair to say that she's indicated on multiple occasions by answering questions, including those from his colleague Nicola Willis, that in fact it was sent as Associate Minister of Transport. Otherwise, she would have said so.
Okay. Why did the Minister state yesterday in the House, I can confirm that the letter was written in my capacity as Transport spokesperson for the Green Party, when we now know that she sent the letter as the Associate Minister of Transport?
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. I can confirm that I am the Associate Minister of Transport. I am also the Green Party spokesperson on transport issues. Many ministers before me, indeed all ministers in successive governments, have held roles as MPs, in some cases party leaders, and also as ministers. I did say yesterday that I sent the letter and the content of the letter was political party consultation, and that is why we consider that it's not in the public interest to release it.
was her 26 March 2019 letter to the Minister of Transport, signed by her as Julie Ann Genta, Associate Minister of Transport?
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. Yes, and of course it is nothing new. It is nothing new for ministers in a government to...
Order. No, that when I stand up, the member sits down, and as I've indicated, this is an area which some of us have quite a lot of interest in and would like to hear the answers. And if National Party members don't want to hear the answers, they may leave.
Shall I answer? Well, I've answered it.
Yeah, I think the member has answered. She certainly answered the question, but...
Does she stand by her statement in Parliament last week? I can assure all members that the government has nothing to hide, and if that's the case, why will she not release her letter about a $6.4 billion transport project for Wellington?
Mr. Speaker, yes, the government has nothing to hide. Indeed, all of the inputs and public consultation about Let's Get Wellington Moving that led to the historic package that this government has achieved are available on the website. The project package that has been announced has support of every regional mayor, the Greater Wellington Regional Council, all of the parties in this government. I know the member is probably feeling a bit embarrassed that this government managed to achieve what his government never did in 9 years.
Why will she not release a letter written in her capacity as Associate Minister of Transport, written on letterhead, marking the Associate Minister of Transport, and signed by her as Associate Minister of Transport to her senior colleague, the Minister of Transport? And is this the sort of transparency that we can expect from this government going forward?
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. As I've explained multiple times in this House to that member, the letter detailed political consultation. And we have accepted advice that we should not release the letter in line with the view of the Ombudsman expressed in June 2019, and that it is not in the public interest because we care about the ability of parties to undertake free and frank consultation. But the result of that consultation is public. The public can all see that finally Wellington is going to get a significant investment in rapid transit, which was the number one issue raised in the public consultation under Let's Get Wellington Moving. All of that is in the public.
Is it now the position of Green Party ministers in the government that ministers or associate ministers can receive information in their capacity as a minister, answer written questions in their capacity as a minister, and write letters in their capacity as associate ministers to other ministers, and then not release that information to the public on the basis that they are Green Party MPs?
Order. I'm going to ask the member to ask the question again, because the minister in her current capacity certainly does not have responsibility for other members of Parliament, notwithstanding their party. And as a member is aware, this is an issue which has been well covered over quite a long period of time, including the time when he was advising a minister.
Thank you for that reference, Mr. Speaker. Is it her position as the Associate Minister of Transport that she can receive information in that capacity, write letters to her senior colleagues about that information as the Associate Minister of Transport and sign it as so, and then not release that information on the basis that political party consultation overrides those obligations?
Mr. Speaker, I know the member is very excited about my stationery and letterhead.
Order. Look, I did some work to get a straight question for the member. I think it ill behoves her then to start off with the sort of approach that we don't expect to come from that quarter of the House.
It is entirely normal, and indeed in successive governments, ministers hold roles also as MPs, and the decision that we've made about the public interest in the letter has to do with the content of the letter, which was normal political consultation. I think the National Party is fishing for some sort of ability to criticise a package that clearly has universal support in Wellington.
Conspiracy theories.
Question number 9, the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Mr Speaker, question to the Associate Minister of Education. Does she stand by her allocation decisions around learning support coordinators in schools?
Who interjected then? Who made that noise? Mr McClay, did you make a noise?
Mr Speaker, if I'd made a noise, I would have stood up and told you that I did so. Right,
okay. The Honourable Nikki Kaye, start again.
Mr Speaker, question to the Associate Minister of Education. Does she stand by her allocation decisions around learning support for coordinators in schools, and does she believe they are targeting children who are most in need?
The Honourable Mr. Tracy Speaker, Martin.
Yes, I stand by my allocation decisions. The first tranche of 623 learning support coordinators was never going to be able to provide an allocation to all schools. What I was trying to ensure was that all of New Zealand had coverage and that that has been achieved, and that this role has the best chance of success. That is why learning support coordinators will be allocated into schools and clusters that are the most advanced in implementing the learning support delivery model in the first instance. To make sure there was a variety of types of schools and settings in this initial allocation, the allocation decisions also took into account some specific characteristics of clusters, such as the proportion of rural schools and the distance between schools, the proportion of Māori and Pacifica students, the number of Māori medium kia ora in a community, and the number of students in the cluster. Learning support needs are part of the diversity of every learning environment. 1 in 5 children and young people receive some form of learning support due to disability, disadvantage, behavioural challenges, and not making progress. For example, 1 in 7 children have dyslexia. We do not currently have a comprehensive national database on learning support need. I intend that there will be further tranches to progressively roll out the learning support coordinators coverage to all schools.
Does she agree with Principal Andrew King, who said regarding her decisions, "This is not about the growing needs of children in whānau or our communities, growing numbers of complicated needs on Senko registers. This is about who has opted sooner for the system the Ministry wants us to be using. I am lost for words, stunned, in fact."
Mr Speaker, no, I do not. I do not agree with that principal's comments. If he goes and has a look at the allocation, and shortly I will seek to table the allocation across New Zealand, there are people who are the most advanced in the learning support delivery model. There are those who are in beginning stages. There are those who have had initial conversations and are moving forward. I have deliberately attempted to make sure that I can cover as many dimensions and diversity of schools and need for children across New Zealand with the first tranche to make the most substantial changes to learning support we have seen since Special Education 2000.
Does she stand by her decisions regarding learning support allocation in the far north, with principals up there saying that they have received hardly any support for children with the most complex needs?
Mr Speaker, yes I do, and at the end of the series of questions I will table a map of New Zealand showing the allocation across all of New Zealand, so that shows that the majority of New Zealand has been covered, 1,000 schools covered by 623 learning support coordinators at a variety of decile levels, at a variety of rural, urban, semi-rural, isolated, Māori medium, English medium, as many varieties as I can get, I have covered in with the number of coordinators that we have.
She say to Principal Gay Turner, who has said, "As a principal of a low decile school who's missed out on a coordinator, while the high decile school up the road was allocated one, I don't know how the allocation of these coordinators addresses the issue of equity."
Mr Speaker, I would welcome that principal to contact my officer directly, and I'm happy to go and speak, as I have offered in any cluster, as I have over the last 12 months spoken about the way that this allocation would be done. I also would point out that when one looks at the numbers around the allocation, that the majority of those have been allocated to those with deciles lower than 5. But I would also point out that there are children, 1 in 7 children in this country, for example, are somewhere on the dyslexia scale. They do not reside in single clusters inside this nation, and they deserve to be supported in their education as much as any other child.
Would you commit?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
the Minister how many of these learning support coordinator positions were funded when she took on the portfolio at the end of 2017?
Mr. Speaker, at the time I took on the portfolio, while the learning support delivery model had been created and was being rolled out under the previous government, there were no learning support coordinator positions backed at that time.
Point of order. I seek leave to table the previous announcement, which showed that there were, I think, 70 learning coordinators under the previous government.
The member seeks to table that document. Is there any objection? There appears to be none.
Will she commit to changing her allocation decisions to ensure that the most disadvantaged children and children with complex needs get the support that they deserve and that there is a more fair and equitable allocation for schools?
Mr. Speaker, at the time of the original announcement of the $217 million required to provide 600, and I note that we have now stretched that to 623 learning support coordinators, it was obvious with 2,500 schools that there would not be a learning support coordinator for every school. The member is asking me now to take away from some schools and give to others. That is not what I am going to do, because the member is asking around need when she cannot prove, where there is no central data collection around need. The member has completely ignored the moderate needs of students across New Zealand, those students with dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, and on a mild autism spectrum. She has asked me to make a decision based on a criteria that does not exist. And so, therefore, I will not be changing the allocation.
Point
of order, Mr. Speaker. I seek leave to table an email by Principal Andrew King to the Minister, whereby
Order. The member seeks to table an email. Well, I'm not going to put it.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, the Honourable Tracy Martin.
I seek leave to table a map showing where the allocation of the first tranche of learning supported coordinators have been placed throughout New Zealand.
And I seek an assurance from the Minister that that map is not otherwise available as part of any Ministry of Education documentation online.
To the best of my knowledge, I had it created for me, but I'm happy to go and check that and seek leave at another time
What I'll do is I'll put the leave on the basis that it is a originally created document, and if the Minister comes, we won't table it. If the Minister comes back to me and says that it's not, then that's solved. Otherwise, she'll table it by the end of the day. Right. Question number. Further supplementary? No. Sorry? Oh, is there any objection to that? Better not be. There appears to be none. Question number 10, Kiritabu Allen.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Employment. What recent labour market reports has he seen that show outcomes for Māori and young people?
Mr. Speaker,
kia ora. Yesterday, the Household Labour Force Survey was released, and I was very pleased to see a drop in the unemployment rate, sir, to 3.9%. The second lowest, sir, in 11 years, and I'm encouraged by the continued positive trends and the reduction of the unemployment rate, sir, for young people and for Māori.
Supplementary, sir. What did the Household Labour Force Survey release indicate for Māori?
Speaker, things get even better there. There are now 6,400 less Māori, sir, unemployed.
Fewer.
With the unemployment rate for Māori dropping to 7.7%, the best in over a decade. What I continue to be encouraged by is the supporting data that shows the underutilisation of Māori is also decreasing, which means for those who want more work, they're getting it.
Good news.
Supplementary, sir. What did the Household Labour Force Survey say for those young people who are not engaged in earning or learning?
Mr. Speaker, the survey released yesterday was positive, with the rate for those not engaged in education, training or employment falling to 10.3%. What this indicates, sir, is that we have successfully activated and engaged 5,000 more rangatahi into employment or skills training. with great support from the Provincial Growth Fund, Sir, and Shane Jones. Programs such as He Pautama Rangatahi,
Order.
Mana in Mahi, and Pai Aronui are really making a difference for our young people, their whānau, and our communities all around the country, Sir.
Question number 11, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Education, does he stand by all his statements, policies and actions around the reform of vocational education?
Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, yes, in the context in which they were made.
Supplementary. Will 1,000 or more polytechnic jobs be lost in the documented $130 million of management team savings?
Mr. Speaker, it is impossible to predict what is the outcome of one of the biggest changes, most positive and aspirational changes to vocational education this country has ever seen. But it is more likely that there will be increased employment around training from the perspective that we are shifting from training just inside the classroom to actually a more comprehensive on-the-job training to better future-proof New Zealand's workforce.
But no, before Dr. Retty takes this question, I'm just going to warn Mr. Bidwell that when he is yelling out next to an open mic, it gets to be very loud, and in this case probably louder than the Minister. He's got to learn to... Thank you.
Supplementary. Is it correct that the documented base case describing the merger of North Tech, WIT and Tai Potini was never discussed with the chief executives of those organisations?
On behalf of the Minister, unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, I'm unable to confirm or deny because I don't have that level of detail with me. If that member wishes to put that question down in writing, I'm sure that the Minister of Education would be happy to answer it.
Supplementary. Will up to $400 million be spent establishing the new mega polytechnic, despite the reforms losing 18,000 learners and 2,310 apprentices per year?
Mr. Speaker, it is possible that that is the amount that the new reforms may cost. Unfortunately, the member is taking out of context, or is the worst case scenario inside the business case around the loss of learners. Unfortunately, the biggest threat at the moment to the loss of learners and apprentices is that member.
Thank you.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Would it be correct, would the Minister believe it to be correct that if the government did nothing and allowed further polytechnics to go broke, that would absolutely certainly lead to job losses?
Mr. Speaker, that is absolutely certain. It does appear, however, that that may have been the plan of the previous government.
Supplementary. Would the Minister stop the reforms if he knew the $400 million establishing the new mega polytechnic is more than the yearly cost of treating all New Zealand women with advanced breast cancer drugs for the next decade?
Order, order. I'm going to ask the member to rephrase the question, which stays within the responsibility of this minister.
A point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, Dr. Shane Retty.
Mr. Speaker, the question started off with the minister...
I listened to the question very carefully, and I'm allowing the member one chance to rephrase it. If he argues, he loses it.
Okay. Let me rephrase it then. I'll repose another question, if I may, if you're asking me to.
Member can do that.
Okay. Are further fees-free underspends reprioritised to pay for these reforms?
Mr. Speaker, to the best of my knowledge, no.
Right. Question number 12, the Honourable Paula Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Women. Does she stand by her statement, quote, "We know there is a huge amount of work to do to make things better for women, and this government is absolutely committed to that work," end quote, and does that work cover unacceptable behaviour ranging from bullying and intimidation to sexual harassment and sexual assault?
The Honourable Julianne Genter.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. Yes, the government is particularly proud to be making changes to end family and sexual violence, including Budget 2019, which had a record $320 million package to break the cycle of family and sexual violence. We've also passed legislation to update the definition of family violence, increase police safety orders to 10 days, enable them to be issued at the same time as an arrest, and encourage agencies to share information to keep people safe.
Justice Undersecretary Jan Logie's bill provided a new right to 10 days domestic violence leave, and I am proud of the government finally apologising to Hayley Brown after many years of legal battles for the working conditions she experienced in the New Zealand Navy, including sexual harassment that she experienced.
When she said the most important thing we can do in dealing with sexual harassment is to create an environment where we are listening to women, where we trust women, does she agree that a safe environment is driven by those in positions of leadership?
Yes.
Does she believe leadership and accountability starts at the top when dealing with allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault?
Yes, I believe it's everyone's responsibility.
What then would she say in response?
Order. Can I just say to members that this is, some of us regard this as a very serious area of questioning, and laughing while the member is asking questions is just not appropriate. Paula Benner.
What then would she say in response to allegations from sexual assault victims that they feel they are not being heard by those in positions of leadership who have a responsibility to protect them?
Mr. Speaker, it's difficult for me to answer when the member's question is quite vague as to what the specific allegations are and who they are regarding. So I'm very happy to answer specific questions if the member wants to put them to me.
Got one more.
One more. Would she expect accountability from the top if that leader had earlier promised to take the time to go and look into it personally?
Again, these are hypothetical questions, and if the member wants to ask me a specific question about a specific person or circumstance, I can try to answer it for her.
That concludes oral questions.